Okay, so a scattering of electrons off. I think one thing I forgot to mention was, remember we talked about opacity, which was basically the cross section divided by mass, or the rate of absorption divided by the surface density. I mean, for Thomson scattering, which, as I said, is ubiquitous in astrophysics because you have many situations where you have just ionized plasma and the photons aren't very energetic, then the opacity would just becomes a number, which is, I guess, it is in the notes. I just saw it here, so I'm just going to write it down for you. Opacity, Thomson opacity, which is it's number density of electrons times sigma t divided by rho. This is by definition. It's I don't know what it's yeah, anyway. So this is for electron scattering. If you can plug in the numbers, and the point is that, of course, most of the density is in ions. But of course, the scattering is done by electrons, so there's a number density of electrons that's coming in here. So you get sigma t divided by 2mh times 1 plus xh, where x is, so this is a standard convention in astrophysics where you say that the fraction of mass in hydrogen is given is x, so x or xh is defined as density of hydrogen divided by density total. In most cases, essentially, in most cases in astrophysics, except for when you're talking about planets, for example, the rest of the mass is in what? In helium. Good, good. I guess it's called Y, which is approximately 1 minus X, and it's just rho helium divided by rho total. And I guess the rest is in what? Metal, that's what. So astronomers call anything that's not hydrogen or helium metals. So metals. So it's called Z, which is basically 1 minus X minus Y. So they're called metals, but I mean, by that standard, oxygen is a metal then. Nitrogen is a metal. So, yeah, so as far as astronomers are concerned, metal. So, this is usually of order what? Anybody? How big is X? 75? 0.7, right. 75%, 0.7, roughly, yeah. So, it exactly, yeah, it depends on, I mean, where are you talking about? Right, like if you're talking about the Big Bang, I think it's more like 75%, but then for stuff that you see around us, like for example, the material that make up the sun, we think the sun is a population one star. That means that the stuff have already gone through one, most have been contaminated by supernova explosions before. So that's why there are metals in the solar system. There are metals in the sun. But then you know what happens in the stars. The stars convert hydrogen to helium. So X in the sun is less than the X that you think is primordially produced. If there's less hydrogen, there's more helium. That's what the stars do primarily. This is of order 0.3, so if it's 0.75, 0.25. And the metals are usually a few percent. So, okay, so here this is how I got 1 plus XH. So the way it works is, so this is something that comes up a lot. So it's good to see this because often radiative processes are done by electrons. But the mass is in ions, and then how that ratio works depends on how much of each element you have. And since it's mostly hydrogen and helium, the way it works is that you get one electron per. So let's see, if you want to do this, the number density of electrons is the number density of electrons of hydrogen, let's say. plus number density of electrons of helium. Of course, I mean, the electrons, if they're free, then they've forgotten where they came from. But, I mean, they must have had an origin at some point. So you cannot separate charges from each other for very much. So, I mean, the ions and electrons don't get very far away from each other. So electrons of hydrogen is the same as the number of protons in hydrogen. I guess I could say protons or H plus. The number density of electrons is, so there are how many electrons for a helium atom? Two, good, so it's two. Number of helium atoms, number density of helium atoms. Okay. And this goes as, so density of density of hydrogen divided by MP. This goes 2 times density of helium divided by, what is the mass of a hydrogen atom? Sorry, helium atom? 4 MP, roughly 4 MP, because it has 2 protons and 2 neutrons. So this gives you, and then using these definitions that I had, this is rho total divided by MP times x plus 2 times 1 minus x divided by 4. And this is just 2. So this is rho total divided by MP times 1 plus x divided by 2. So that's how I got this 1 plus x. So this combination comes in often if you're, let me write it closely. If you're interested in number density of electrons, we want to relate it to the density of the medium. Okay. So there might be other places where some places, if you're interested in pressure, for example, then you want number density of electrons, and then you want number density of ions. So then you get a different combination of x there. But for radiative processes, you usually get this because you're interested in number density of electrons because they do most of the radiative processes. But then what you have, you want to relate things to the mass, which depend on the density. Good. And this number is roughly 0.2 1 plus x. And the units would be what? I guess I have a square centimeter per gram. So this is a cross section per unit mass, right? So this is a number to have in mind. It's a typical, and it's independent of frequency. So if you have ionized astrophysical material or ionized plasma, then for every gram of it, you have 0.2 square centimeter absorption, number of order 1. It's kind of like water, huh? I don't know. Sounds like a coincidence. OK, good. So that's Thomson opacity. That's the number to have in mind. But I guess it's like more like 0.4, because x is of order 0.7. So it's more like 0.3 to 0.4. OK. So as I said, this Thomson scattering is quite useful in astrophysics because you have lots of electrons, and then you have many situations you're dealing with ionized medium. So there is this process called Comptonization. Comptonization. And that's basically when you have repeated Compton scattering. So why do I say Compton scattering? So I mean, of course, there is a Thomson scattering, the non-relativistic limit of Compton scattering. But in the strict limit of Thomson scattering, energy of photons doesn't change. So if you start with some spectrum of photons, Thomson scattering itself doesn't change the spectrum of photons. But then if you have repeated the scatterings, the spectrum can't change because of relativistic effects. So relativistic effects are small, but of course this cross-section is big, so if you have lots of scatterings, they could add up. And so this is, write it down, this leads to a change in the spectrum. So this is the stuff we already discussed, the Thomson differential cross section. I guess I have a speed of light here. And then so n gamma, this is, these are n gammas are occupation numbers, which are the same as the phase space densities up to 2 pi h bar factors. I guess h bar is 1 here in this formula. I'm not 100% sure. Is it 1? I think it's 1 because it must be h bar sitting here. Well, we'll figure it out at some point. So this is a function of omega. This is n gamma of omega prime 1 plus n gamma omega n e p minus n gamma of omega one plus gamma of omega prime and E of P prime. These are vectors. Okay. So what are we talking about here? So we're talking about Compton scattering, as we discussed before. So there is a photon of energy h bar omega. It's coming. And then it goes out with another energy, h bar omega prime. Right? And then the reason it changes momentum is it scatters off an electron of momentum p prime. I'm not sure, is it p or p prime? So let's see. So we're interested in how this guy changes. So let's just look at this process, this term. So in this term, there is a photon of, let's see, right. So this is a stimulated emission. Remember, wherever you had 1 plus n, it was a stimulated emission. Or this was a spontaneous emission, and this was a stimulated or induced emission. So, do I have the right sign here? I think it has to be the right sign. So what am I doing here? So there's a proton of, there's an electron of momentum P that's coming in. It becomes a momentum of momentum P prime. And the rate at which this goes as a cross section, if the number density was small, so the thing that's good. Okay, so this is omega prime going to omega. So, see, this has a plus sign. So it says that I'm decreasing. There's a momentum photon of energy omega prime or h bar omega prime that is scattering off electrons of density NE, and the rate of a scattering would be this this density times this density, right? Well, this is not quite a density. This is phase space density. I have to integrate over position to get the density, but I mean that's done somewhere, I'm guessing. I think this formula is correct given that there is no frequency dependence in the cross section. Yeah. So Okay, you can go through this. So this formula is correct. So if there was no stimulated emission, you just had, you were scattering these guys against these electrons, and then we got to, and you made photons of energy h bar omega. This would be the formula. But then since there is h bar omega, since there is a stimulated emission, the rate of this process happening depends on how many photons already exist in this state. The more photons you have already in this state, the more of this happens. And that's why you have 1 plus n here. So that's one of the important features of quantum processes, that is you don't have just have a spontaneous, the rate of something happening for bosons is proportional to how many states, or a rate of transition into a bosonic state is proportional to how many, or 1 plus how many bosons exist there. Now you can guess for fermions what happens. For fermions, you have 1 minus here. That means that if you already have a fermion there, nothing can go in it. For bosons, it's the reverse of that, it's 1 plus. So if there already a boson there, you already have photons there, then the rate of producing more photons there in that state increases. That makes sense. So that's the difference between bosons and fermions. In this plus becomes a minus for fermions. And then this time is just the reverse of that happening. If you have a process that could populate certain momentum for photons, there is also same process could also depopulate it, because these photons could scatter and leave this momentum state. And on average, these two should cancel each other for thermal distribution. And this is something that's very easy to modify and to verify. If you assume that this is a Boltzmann distribution, we can just do this. We can just do this to verify it. Just use this. This is 1 over h bar omega over t. Let me just don't write omega h bar and k, just for brevity. 1 plus n gamma, and this is omega prime. 1 plus n gamma is e to the omega t pi by e to the omega over t minus 1. This is proportional to e to the minus p squared over 2me t. And this should be, and my claim is that this is equal to the same thing if I replace omega and omega prime. Then the denominator is the same already, because it has a product of this guy and this guy, which is the same as what I have here. And then e to the minus p prime squared over 2me t. So these cancel these denominators. And then for these guys to be the same, it just requires that omega, omega minus p squared over 2me should be omega prime minus p squared, p prime squared over 2me. Right? But this is just energy conservation. I can just put this omega prime and p there. It says omega plus p prime. This is basically energy of electron prime. This is equal to h bar omega prime plus energy of electron, which is just energy conservation in this process. So it tells you that at thermal, if electrons and photons have the same temperature, then this is an equilibrium distribution, at least for photons. You could write a similar thing for electrons as well. Okay. And of course, this is independent of any cross section that I put here. Now, depending on the process, then the cross section could be different. Right. Okay. Any questions? So now what I'm interested in is how much energy changes. Basically, the important thing is, what is the cross section? This cross section depends both on omega and omega prime. This is the function of both omega and omega prime. And It turns out that, as you see here, the change in omega depends on the energy of kinetic energy of electrons, that is. So I should be clear, this is kinetic energy of electrons. So if electrons are non-relativistic, the kinetic energy is not very big. I mean, the kinetic energy is of order temperature. So so the kinetic energy is of order temperature. Is this obvious? I think I need another factor here. Delta E. I'm missing something here. Right. Okay. So this is just energy conservation. There is a momentum conservation as well. The momentum conservation tells me that but the change in the momentum of the photon should be of order of the change in the momentum of the electron. So how does that work out? So my claim is that the change in the energy of photon, let's see whether I can verify it. It would be of order E gamma. times E gamma divided by M E C S squared. Okay, so that's my claim. Okay, now good. So there's an easy way to see this. And that's by just noticing that the photon is scattered by an order of an angle. So there's a momentum that the photon imparts on the electron. And that momentum is of order, for photon, the momentum is of order energy. So it's E gamma. So delta P, the momentum exchange, is of order E gamma. Right? But then if I know the change in momentum, I can estimate the change in energy, right? Because this electron has the energy of electron, I know it's P squared, P of electron squared divided by 2m. So the change in energy is going to be it's going to be roughly PE divided by ME times delta PE, delta P. And delta P was E gamma. So it's E gamma PE divided by ME. And PE divided by ME is what? It's, I can relate it to, yes, sure. Right. So this is the Thomson limit of Compton scattering. Right. So if you want to go to strictly Thomson, then this is zero. Right?
That's why we are assuming like non-relativistic.
That's right. So exactly. So these are small. So the limit that these go to zero, delta E gamma goes to zero. So let me finish this, but yeah, basically you're right. So if momentum of electron is much less than its mass, then this change in energy is going to be a small, right? Because this changes. That's right, exactly. That's the limit. Or basically, I guess in this frame, it says that in the rest frame of electron, they would stay still. In the general lab frame, it means that electrons barely deviate from the trajectory, right? So the scattering angle is very small for the electron, exactly. And this is basically the argument why that's the case. So this delta E electron, which is the same as delta E gamma by energy conservation, is going to be E gamma times momentum of electron divided by mass, which is basically the velocity of electrons, if you will, right? So delta E gamma divided by E gamma is roughly just momentum of the electron divided by its mass, which is that the velocity of electron, basically, by speed of light. Or you could convert it to temperature. Velocity in terms of temperature is a square root of kBT e divided by m electron. So this is a square root of temperature of electrons And then this is MeCS squared is mass of electrons, which is 511 keV. Right. So as long as your temperature is much less than roughly an MeV, or I can just write half an MeV if you, it's just easier, half an MeV. Then as individual scattering changes energy very little. So that's how the argument works. And in fact, you can just go this, and instead of the squiggles that I have here, do it exactly, because the main argument is that, the main assumption is that in the rest frame of the electron, you have Thompson scattering. So the change in the momentum of the electron is just given by a standard Thompson cross-section that you know. So you know exactly what delta P is, and you know what its probability distribution is. And from that, you can basically get the change in, so that you have delta P, which is the same as E. Distribution of delta P is the same as, the magnitude is energy of the photon, and the distribution is given by just the differential cross-section of Thompson cross-section. And from that, you can find the change in energy of electron as well. I guess for the purpose of this, all you care about is the change in the energy of photon, which of course is the same as the change in energy of electron. So this can be done exactly, or by exactly I mean that you can get the probability distribution of delta E gamma, because it's a stochastic process, right? Depends on the scattering angle. And when you do that, what you get is, for many subsequent scatterings, you get essentially a random walk. You get a random walk. Because this is a stochastic, as I said, depends on the scattering angle, which is random. It's a random process. But it's the smallest step. So all you care about when you do the random walk with the smallest steps, because this is a small, is the first and second moment of a random walk. And this is something that's known as the Fokker-Planck equation in general. Fokker-Planck equation. This is just a general equation for a random walk, assuming Gaussian distribution. And I mean, these distributions aren't necessarily Gaussian, but that's the other thing about the smaller steps, that you could show small steps can be usually approximated as Gaussian. This can be shown here as well. Or in fact, the higher order moments don't really matter very much. So, and then you end up with an equation that looks like, so depend only on first, second order moments. So, delta E gamma, which is what we care about. So that is delta E gamma and delta E gamma squared. And the equation you end up with is basically you can do this integral. You can do the integral over momenta because we know this is assuming these are thermal, and this integral can be done as well, assuming that basically it's a Gaussian, this delta E gamma is a Gaussian distribution. And you get something that looks like this. I don't know really if I have to write it down, but I guess now I do, since I started. Supposed to be simpler than this. Right. Okay. So I'm not going to write down the full, the general random walk, the general random walk Fokker-Planck equation. I'm not going to write that down. You can find it in the notes because it's a little bit too long. I'm just going to write down the final result, which looks like this. So x here is h bar omega divided by kT, temperature of electrons, that is. And y is pt over mec squared times ne sigma t ct. So this is known as a Compton y parameter. It's dimensionless. And this x is just the ratio of energy of photon to energy of to the thermal energy of electrons. So this is like a diffusion equation, which is, I mean, Fokker-Planck equation is a version of the diffusion equation. However, in terms of some dimensionless coordinate position and some dimensionless time, that the meaning of this dimensionless time is actually very easy to understand. This combination, Ne sigma ct, is what? Just if in terms of Thompson scattering, what does this combination mean? No. Number of scattering, optical depth, exactly. This is optical depth for Thompson scattering. So it makes sense that, the evolution of the density of photons, distribution of photons, should depend on the number of scatterings. But then it has this extra factor. And what do you think the meaning of this extra factor? Why does it have an extra factor? It's related to that, what's there, that next, last line. Right. So it's the point is that the scattering that changes your energy a little, right? So you need only by this amount, you see, or by a square root of that amount. So the moment of the relative change or the variance of the change in energy is in fact kT divided by mAc squared. So one scattering is not enough. You need many of them, basically one over that many scatterings, to have order one changes in energy, right? And that's the meaning of this y parameter. So if this y parameter becomes order one, then energy of the photons change by order one. If tau becomes of order one, you have order one scattering, but if these are non-relativistic electrons, then that doesn't change the distribution very much. Okay, and then if you solve this, so there are two limits you could think about. It's actually kind of interesting. There's a limit that people haven't seen people discuss. But so the usual units is, limits is if this thing vanishes in the if this guy in the parenthesis vanishes, and that's just the thermal distribution. That's what we verified here. The thermal distribution. If you have thermal distribution with the right temperature, basically if temperature of electrons is the same as temperature of photons, then this should vanish. You can just simply verify that. So that would be the limit that you expect if y is very big, then this thing should go into its equilibrium. So you could show that's a stable equilibrium. So this is a dispersion, this is a diffusion equation, and a fixed point of that diffusion is when this thing vanishes. Right. The other limit is the optically thin limit, or Compton thin limit, I could say. Although I should say it doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be exactly thermal. Any e to the x minus x naught plus one or minus one, sorry. N is proportional to this, or n is equal to this, is equilibrium. Can anybody say why there is an x naught here, and what is the physical interpretation of this x naught? So it doesn't have to be exactly thermal. X was h bar omega divided by kT. Even if thermal but shifted with a constant, there's still equilibrium. Sorry, I should remember.
Is it related to omega naught?
Omega naught. What is omega naught?
I guess if you use the definition of x on the side of the h bar omega kt.
Right, so this is the definition, right? So it's, let me see, I just want to turn this off, but doesn't want to turn off, I guess. Yeah, so no more distractions. Right, so I mean, this formula is just, it's just 1 over e to the h bar omega over kt minus x naught minus 1. So it's not quite a thermal distribution. It's different from a thermal distribution. It is different from a black body distribution, I should say. Good, exactly. So it is a chemical potential. And you see, remember why we needed the chemical potential. If the number is conserved, then the thermal equilibrium has a chemical potential in it. And the processes that we're considering here, it doesn't change the number of photons. Photon comes in, photon goes out. Doesn't change the number of photons. So it cannot change the number of photons if it brings that, it can bring it to thermal equilibrium with electrons up to the chemical potential, because this scattering cannot change the number of photons. It can change its energy distribution. So this one, you need processes that can change the number of photons. Like one of them is called double Compton scattering, that instead of one photon being emitted, you could have two photons being emitted here, or two photons absorbed, one photon. This is known as double Compton scattering. And Bremerstrahlung, that we're going to discuss next. That's another process that changes the number of photons. So if you want to get exact black body distribution from radioactive processes, you need one of those processes that changes the number of photons to basically make x naught zero. And so the other thing I wanted to mention is the optically thin limit of this, or the Compton thin limit of this. That's known as the thermal SZ effect. Or at least that's one of the applications of this. That's when y is much less than 1. And this is also known as the y distortion as well, I mean, more generally. Y distortion, or I guess there are other names for it. What are other names for it? I think it's called inverse Compton as well. I mean, Compton and inverse Compton are the same. But I think that this distinction is a little bit semantics, that usually when you think about Compton scattering, you have electron at rest, a photon is coming and giving energy to electron. Inverse Compton is the reverse, that you have an energetic electron, low energy photon, and the photon gains energy by interacting with electrons. You have hot electrons. So thermodynamics of the Lovich effect is where you have a lot of these hot electrons in clusters of galaxies. So you have a cluster of galaxies. So clusters of galaxies, most of the mass in them, in fact, is not in galaxies. So it's a little bit confusing. Most of the gas in them happens to be in between galaxies in some ionized phase with temperature between 1 keV to 10 keV. Temperature of electrons, which is roughly the same as temperature of ions. And CMB photons, when they come through this, they can gain energy, basically, through interaction. And since y is a small for them, so y, do I have the number for y for them? I don't have it. Well, I should be able to estimate this, right? So the change in the distribution of photons, delta n, would be proportional to basically y roughly divided by x to the fourth d by dx. So now the important thing is that the temperature of electron So the photons might have a thermal distribution, electrons might have a thermal distribution, but they have different temperatures. So this expression looks doesn't vanish, even though you're plugging in the thermal distribution. Because so here there is, I guess I can just write down the same thing. Dn by dx plus n squared. But n is 1 over e to the omega divided by temperature of CMB. So T of CMB is 10 to the minus 4 electron volt, roughly. Right. But then x is omega divided by T of electrons. Or h bar omega, I can put the h bars on k's, h bar k. So since these temperatures are very different, in fact, this is not zero, and this is a particular expression. So this is something you could see in the CMB. And what you actually see is you look at this delta n omega, delta n gamma as a function of omega. You see that since you're not changing the number, you're taking some low energy photons, scattering them onto high energies, so you have a deficit of low energy photons, and you have what is the opposite of deficit? Increment, I guess. Increment of high energy photons. And for CMB spectrum, this happens to be at 220 gigahertz. Exactly. So this is a very characteristic signature that you can use to find clusters of galaxies in the sky. So if I remember correctly, so I guess I can estimate y from here, or can I estimate y from here? So I mean, the relative change in the temperature is something of order 10 to the minus 5. So I think y is of order 10 to the minus 5, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So that means that tau is, so TE divided by ME. This is KeV divided by MeV. So this is 10 to the minus 3. So that means that the optical depth should be of order 10 to the minus 2. So the optical depth for Thompson scattering is significant. It's of order of a percent. But you don't see its effect on the temperature because there's this extra suppression by this factor of 10 to the minus 3. So the Y factor, well, you do see it, but the effect isn't quite as big. It's of order 10 to the minus 5. And yes, and it's very characteristic because low frequencies, it looks like the clusters are darker. They are holes in the CMB. At high frequencies, they are increments. They are brighter than the CMB. Surplus. Well, I don't know.
Excess,
right. But did I say?
Increment.
But what's wrong with increment?
Doesn't that kind of like a small?
Well, increase, a small increase, right. So, well, anyway, it doesn't matter what you call it. Yeah. Did somebody, yeah.
So this changes
from the temperature of the photons,
right?
But technically it doesn't change the temperature, it changes the distribution of photons, right? Because it's not thermal anymore. It's a Y distortion, right? It's just basically changes, you start from thermal and then you have some change according to this equation. Or, well, it's just this formula. This is
but
the formula.
If you change, but if you're still assuming that it's thermal,
so then the temperature you get would depend on frequency. I mean, you can define a temperature, right, using this relationship, like, at each frequency, but then you get different temperatures for different frequencies.
Yeah, maybe my aim of my question is, like, when we measure
CMB, right,
how sure we are that these things won't affect.
No, they do affect it to some extent, right? But I mean, the thing is that this is a deviation from thermal spectrum. Right? And one thing I said about CMB is very thermal. It's actually the most precise thermal black body that we've ever seen. So these effects, in fact, on average, they are constant at this level. That on average, in the whole sky, should be less than 10 to the minus 5. Now, along individual directions, along clusters of galaxies, we do detect this as high significance. We do detect these distortions. Right. Good. So that's this is known as a Y distortion, and incidentally, this is known as a mu distortion. If you hear this. So you could have processes that inject energy into photons or do something to photon distribution, but that doesn't change their number. So you reach thermal equilibrium, but you don't reach chemical potential. So if you say inject, for example, if you have say, in early universe, you have some particle decays and produces photons. Those photons might be able to equilibrate amongst themselves, but if you cannot change their number, then you equilibrate to a mu distorted thermal spectrum. This process, is the idea is that you are optically thin, so that even the distribution of photons doesn't change because y is small. So so this y distortion, the assumption is it's optically thin, or at least Compton thin. So you got here, you got this. Here is the Compton thick. This is Compton thick. Y goes to infinity, but the other processes that change the numbers, they are not efficient. Like double Compton, for example, should be thin. Okay. Good. So that's any questions? Yes.
That one is Compton thick.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, this is Compton thick. So that means that if y goes to infinity, then n goes to this L equilibrium, right? Where x naught is something that depends on how many photons you start with. So this is Compton thick. I mean, I guess there could be other ways of getting this, but I mean, this is one way of getting this. It could have other processes that are. This is Compton thin, yeah, so it's thin. So because y is much less than 1, right, so it's Compton thin. Right. Okay, so these are different types of distortion from the CMB spectrum. So yeah, if you're looking at the CMB. Okay, so the next thing we're going to look at, let's see how much, I guess I feel I'm running slowly. So the next thing I was going to do was Bremerstrahlung. Oh, good, okay, I mean, I guess we're on track. So the next one is Bremerstrahlung or free emission. And then I was going to show you just some pictures if we get, yeah, I think I should be okay. Right. So Bremerstrahlung, we're going to go back to our magic formula. Right. So let's see. Okay. So any questions about this? Nope. So as I was saying, Thomson scattering is nice and in many situations very useful. Like I did my PhD thesis on detection of thermal Sanyaev's Lovich effect, so it can be useful if you want to get a PhD in astrophysics. But sometimes you really need to change the create or destroy photons because I mean, you're not always. Let's see, what's the best strategy? I think the best strategy is to actually erase this. Right, strategies erase this. So yeah, so this is one thing you remember. You have to remember if you work with this board. I think it's always good to start with the middle board. That's my which I guess I never quite remember at the right time. Okay, so Bremerstrahlung is the process that's most common, at least in ionized plasmas, in terms of how to produce photons. So let's see. I'm going to try to. Well, I'm going to make a fool of myself now. Can Tommy help me? SSRA. H, L, E, N, G. Ah, okay, it wasn't that bad. As long as I follow instructions. Bremerstrahlung. Okay. So, let's do this. So, And I guess now I feel I've done quite a bit of this already in the first week. So I'm not going to go through it as much detail. Well, maybe a little bit. I'm just going to just write down, I guess, the magic formula. The coefficient is the magic formula. 2/3, good. Q squared is squared over C cubed. And acceleration is or approximately Z E squared over MEB. B squared, Z is the atomic number, I guess that's what it's called, for the ion. Or I guess if it has electrons, it's basically the charge of the ion. So B is the impact parameter. So the process is you have an electron passing by an ion. They're exchanging a photon. I guess this is a virtual photon. The distance is B. And then they emit a photon here. This is the ion. This is the electron. So the formula that we wrote last time, and it's basically, you can just refresh our memory. T total is called NE, NI, dE by dt, times delta t, it's 1 over omega max, times relative velocity, times 2 pi b dB. OK, so acceleration, I wrote it down there. So this formula is so what is this formula? So dE by dt is the rate at which you're losing energy per one scattering event, or during one scattering event. Delta t is the length of one scattering event, and that's roughly given by 2b divided by v relative, or I guess this is same as v relative. So basically, it's saying that you have b here, and b here. And most of emission happens when you are within that region. And even farther away, acceleration is much smaller. So you don't have that much emission. I mean, if you can do it more. It's actually easy to do this more formally. Just integrate acceleration, which is this formula, with some cosine angle. Just integrate that along the line of propagation. This is assuming a small angle scattering. So the trajectory, we can assume, is a straight line. I mean, you can do it even for the case of a like hyperbolic orbit, because that would be the orbit, at least in classical mechanics. So that's even more precise way of doing this. But I mean, those are just a standard. They give you something of this order, as long as the deflection angle is not very big. And then there is a 1 over omega max. So the omega max is the maximum frequency at which you're emitting the photons, which is roughly pi over delta t. So omega max is just saying that, OK, so you're emitting, this is the total energy, but the time scale is delta t. So the frequency, even though you would be emitting in all frequencies, the half its max of that frequency would be of this order, of 1 over delta t. So you wouldn't be emitting many photons at much higher frequency than this typical time scale. So that's the explanation of all of this. And then 2 pi b dB is the surface area for a differential cross-section. Multiplied by velocity and number density of electron is the flux. So that's per ion. And if you want the total emission per unit volume, you multiply that by the number density of ions. So that's everything else there is in there. And if you plug in everything here, you get the final formula, which is the celebrated Bremer-Stahl-Lang 16 Z squared, E squared, N E, N I, divided by 3, M E squared, C cubed, your relative, log of B max, log of B mean. Okay. So, so there's a maximum B, which is, now let's see, I have a B max here, which is a bit, I see, good, good. I see what's the story. C cubed. Right, C cubed.
And E is the charge of the electron?
E is charge of electron. Right. Yeah. Okay, and you could see why it's, right, so, okay, so now the next thing is for us to decide. Of course, I mean, this is most, up to an order of magnitude, this is all you need. This log is never very big. But then if you want to do this more properly, you want to figure out where these limits come from. And in fact, I mean, they go to the heart of this classical approximation, that whether it's a good thing or not. So, so B max is, I think I might have then said something I wasn't quite right when the first week. So what I have here is B max is roughly given by B relative divided by omega. Okay, does this make sense? Right. Okay. So what happens if you have a very large? So what is this combination? Is this even doesn't even have the right unit? Yes, it does have the right unit. So.
Isn't that in meters per radian?
Hmm?
It's in meters per radian.
You mean this guy, right? Right. Well, I mean that's right. Radian is not a unit. it doesn't have dimensions by that. I mean, so this has the right. Yeah. So it's just it has the unit of length. Do I say so? Can somebody guess why that is the maximum? So what happens? For impact parameter larger than this.
Omega is a frequency of
emitted photon. Yeah. Omega is a frequency of emitted photon. So I guess this is saying that B should be less than this B max. B should be less than V relative divided by omega. Or it says that omega should be less than B relative divided by B. And this is a, I guess this is, a, okay, so I'm a bit confused, but I guess this is the same as the delta T we had there. Right. B relative divided by B. So what am I missing there? B relative divided by B. Yeah, there's some, yeah, I somehow, I mean, right. So there was a good reason. I
does it describe sort of the characteristic time scale of the
It is the characteristic time scale. It's, so it's saying that the frequency, yeah, go ahead, sir.
So I guess, is that saying if you have a larger impact parameter than that, you don't interact long enough to emit?
To emit photons that are higher frequency than, but so it just says that. Yeah, so for a given impact, I mean, I think this is essentially the same as this, as far as, I don't think it's terribly deeper than that. I was thinking, this is a purely classical condition, as far as I could say. I was thinking there was a quantum, but the quantum one is a different one. So yeah, this is just the same condition as that. It's just saying that if you have, there's a maximum frequency, just saying this, that there is that this omega max, just this condition, basically. I guess up to a pi factor. Right. So for fixed omega, there's a maximum B that contributes, which is just V divided by omega. Bs that are longer contribute to lower frequencies, but they don't contribute to this frequency. So it makes sense because they're longer. Just they take longer. The processes with larger Bs. Okay, so that's for fixed frequency, this would be the B max. And then the B mean, and I mean, you don't need to know this very well because they only entered in the log. So factors of order one are not important. I mean, these are calculated numerically, and I'm going to show you what they are. The B mean, there are two, there's a classical B mean, and that's basically where. This a small angle approximation that we made here breaks down. So that's basically when the momentum exchange between electron and proton becomes comparable to the original momentum of the proton, or sorry, of the electron, so that you don't have a straight line. You have a bona fide hyperbolic orbit. So that's basically just MeV. Electron of your relative squared over 2 divided by ZE squared. So basically this says that the electrostatic energy becomes comparable to the kinetic energy. So then that basically you have a deflection that's significant. So you have to do this more properly. And that cuts off the logarithmic divergence, in fact. You also have a quantum effect where if B gets very small, then so what happens if you get, so let's say B mean quantum is H bar divided by MeV. Okay, so this is what I was thinking about the first, right? So this is just saying that photons have angular momentum, right? So if you're emitting a photon, so let's say B should be less than H bar MeV relative, which says, so B should be bigger than, sorry, B, this is B minimum, so B should be bigger than this. So this says that basically angular momentum of electron should be bigger than H bar. So what does that mean? Right, because so MeV relative times B is the angular momentum of the electron. So if it's less than H bar, then it cannot emit a photon because the photon has angular momentum of H bar, right? And if your electron ion system has an angular momentum less than an H bar, basically, quantum mechanically, it's not capable of emitting a photon. So of course, both of these are conditions. So B should be bigger than the maximum of these two. Right? B should be bigger than maximum of B mean quantum and B mean classical. OK. Good, so Okay, so this is roughly how to get it, and this log is called a Gaunt factor. If I want to do it properly, in using the definition that exists in the literature, I should put so this is equal to 16 pi z squared e to the 6 n squared divided by 3 s squared of 3 m e squared c cubed v. I guess it's the same up to here. And then I guess then there's a square root of 3. This is different here. And then this is times the Gaunt factor, GFF. Depends on omega and v. And I guess it just says that this Gaunt factor, GFF, is a square root of 3 over pi log of b max divided by b min. Okay, so this is called the Gaunt factor. And this depends, of course, on velocity. But if you have a thermal distribution, you can average over all the velocities. There is some subtlety on the averaging as well. But So there's a minimum velocity, which goes as, so the subtlety in the averaging, where should I write it down? Let me write it down here. So there's a minimum energy of electron, which is h bar omega. Because if it's less than that, then of course it cannot emit a photon. And with that condition, if you average 1 over v, which is what matters here, over the thermal distribution, then you get a square root of 2me over pi kt e to the minus h bar omega divided by kt. So if h bar goes to 0, this is just thermal averaging. It's something you do with the Boltzmann distribution. But then there is this condition that these very small velocities cannot emit photons, and that puts the cutoff here. That if you're talking about very high frequencies, very high frequency photons, then this cuts off your emission mechanism, right? Because basically thermal energies are insufficient to lead you to emission. So these are tabulated. Maybe we can just plug in now to show this, because I think I don't have any more formulas. So these are tabulated. You can look them up either in the textbook or in just a standard books. Okay. Presentation. Which one is it? I guess it's A. Start. And by the way, I fixed the links in the course homepage, so that makes you happy. Is that Skype or something? I don't want to Skype. Courses. Is that coming? Hopefully it is. Lecture files can be found here. This is lecture 7, I believe. Okay, good. Oh, it's hard to see this here. So this is the stuff we discussed. Let's see. So I don't know how well you can see this. Right. So these are just expressions for the Gaunt factor averaged over temperatures. You see, Right, so the Gaunt factor, just the, you see, it only has logarithmic dependence, right? So just if you plug in B max and B mean, you get this logarithmic dependence, and you have two different regimes because you go from classical to quantum B mean. I'm not quite sure which one is which, but I guess you can figure it out. Can we figure it out? Whichever has H bar in it. Yeah, I guess it's this one has H bar in it, so this is the quantum mean. This is the top one is the classical one. And gamma is, gamma is just an exponential Euler's constant. I'm not sure why that's there, but if there's something over order one, that doesn't matter. So there's a, so this is just a convenient fitting formula for this. You can use, but again, it's just logarithmic. So the number to have in mind is that this is of order 12 or so. Right. So let's see what else. So you can calculate the. So you see, remember there was a relationship between emissivity. So what we calculated here was J, which was how fast you would emit Bremerstrahlung. But you could remember there was this consistency relation between absorption and emission, just basically this A and B coefficients, Einstein A and B coefficient. So if you know, given the fact that you know, I mean, electrons or plasma of a temperature should be in equilibrium with photons of the same temperature, you could actually relate, find the absorption, which is this alpha absorption coefficient, right, to the emission coefficient. So it's basically alpha is just J divided by the black body spectrum. So you can define an opacity based on alpha, which is alpha divided by density. And then this is the free-free or Bremerstrahlung opacity. Okay. So, and I think the units are, units are, I guess, CGS units. So temperature is Kelvin here, and rho is gram per square centimeter. So it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit confusing, this the way this is written here. But, I mean, so. This is rho in CGS units, T in CGS units. So now compare this with what we had before for Thomson opacity. So this is, I think, averaged over frequency. So I'm not 100% sure whether that's the right comparison. But I mean, this is, well, let's see. I'm not 100% sure about which regime. Let me see, check which frequency regime it is. There was a textbook there, yeah, okay. So, yeah, I don't remember which frequency regime this was at. Well, add it somewhere. Why did it disappear? Oh, good. Found it. Okay, so this is for opacity of order, right, this is for opacity of, sorry, for frequency of order temperature, which I guess kind of makes sense because that's where most of the absorption would happen. So for Thomson, it was of order 1 centimeter squared per gram. This looks much bigger, at least for density and temperature of Kelvin, I think. But of course, you want to go to temperature much higher. Like, if you want to have ionized material, your temperature would be of order of a few thousand, let's say 10,000 Kelvin. So that's 10 to the 4 times 3.5 is what? It's 4. 4 times 3.5 is 2 times 7 is 14. So this is down to like 10 to the 8 or so, looks like. So For photons that have the same energy as the temperature, then this is more efficient absorption than Thomson. Oh, okay. Right. This is more efficient than Thomson. Still puzzling me. It doesn't make sense. Huh. Hope there's no typo there. That's the number. Right. So, am I? Yeah, no, that's the opacity. I think that's correct. Okay. So, and let me just show you some examples of this, basically Compton, the Bremer-Stahlung emission. So this is examples of what you get for I nu in a hot plasma. Can I make that bigger? I cannot make this bigger. Huh. Yeah. For some reason, that's not the way to make this bigger. Save, print, click on. Anyway, I guess you can see it. So this is a temperature of, well, 8. Wow. Sorry, you don't see it, but I can read it for you. So the left is 10 to the 8 Kelvin, which is 9 keV roughly. And the right is of order of 100 electron volt. So it's like 0.1 keV. So the difference in temperature is a factor of 100. This is 10 to the 8 Kelvin. This is 10 to the 6 Kelvin. And what you notice is at very high temperature, everything is ionized. So you just have Bremer-Stahlung, which is this nice formula, which is what we had somewhere. Well, you see the exponential turn off is this e to the minus h bar omega over kt. So it turns off at of order of 10 keV, which is the temperature. And then this power law, I'm not sure what the units is. So in the units that I calculated must be constant. So I think it's in some, you multiply it by omega or something like that to get the power law. But it's basically some smooth power law. I guess in units I calculated, d by dt is just a constant. And then it exponentially cut off here. And then there are some lines. So that's because there's a little bit of bound emission because some very heavy ions, this is for typical cosmic densities, aren't quite ionized. So there are some spectral lines. At much lower temperatures, then you see a lot of ions that aren't completely stripped of their electrons. So you have, there's a lot of line emissions here. This is comparable to Bremer-Stahlung. So the Bremer-Stahlung peaks at 100 eV. So this is the power law with a smooth cutoff. But then there is a lot of other stuff that's happening that are comparable and actually dominate. So that's the lesson that basically about a keV or 0.1 keV is when you transition from line-dominated cooling to pure Bremer-Stahlung. And that basically coincides with when you completely ionize everything, basically. So you would think it's 13.6 electron volt, but that's just for hydrogen. For other ions, we do have other ions, and in fact, these guys dominate that. The cooling process, because line emission, when you do have atoms, it could be much more significant than Bremer-Stahlung. So, I mean, I don't know if there's a good explanation of why that is. I'm sure there is. So this is, and I mean, this is an example of like this decomposition of this. This is the total cooling just as a function of temperature. So it's integrated over all frequencies. So the Bremer-Stahlung, what we had, which you cannot see here, if you integrate, it goes as ns squared times temperature to the 1/2, so the temperature dependence, if you integrate over all frequencies. But then as you go to lower temperature, these line emissions also come in. And you can see how they dominate at lower temperatures. So the hydrogen is only at very low temperatures. As you go to, I mean, this is what I was saying. As you go to high temperature, the hydrogen is fully ionized, but then there are these other ions that aren't fully ionized, and they all contribute. So basically, as you ionize these ions, the contribution increases, and then it decreases So here they're fully neutral, like oxygen here is fully neutral, so it doesn't contribute. Here it's fully ionized, it doesn't contribute. But as your temperature reaches the ionization temperature of oxygen, then they contribute. And so this is an important curve to use, and you can tabulate it and you can find it in textbooks, because this is important, say, for example, for a star formation, this cooling curve, that's what it's called, lambda of T, which is tells you basically how fast gas loses its energy, because that's what it needs to do to form a stars, for example, or galaxies, etc. Okay, thank you. I think that's it for me. Any questions? No questions? Not? See you on Tuesday, I believe. And that's